There's my music. Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. This program today, this evening, depending upon the time zone you're in, is a tribute to Hugh Hefner, otherwise known as Hef. And Hef was a sexual and social pioneer for sure. And who better to remember him than my good friend of 20 years, Barbie Benton. And Barbie was Hef's good friend for close to 50 years. And Barbie, I hope you're on the other line. Hello, Barbie.
Surprise, I am here and I'm on time.
Yes. It's interesting that Hef has his burial plot is next to Marilyn Monroe, who famously said, "The only time I was on time was when I was on a calendar." Anyway, Barbie, I appreciate so much. I know you've been getting so many requests to talk about Hef, and you're in the current People magazine about Hef. I haven't quite yet read that one, but there's also, I want to tell people that there's a wonderful publication, a special commemorative edition from Newsweek on Hugh Hefner, and there are several beautiful shots of you, 1970, with Hef going to the Academy Awards. You were a Playboy icon in the 60s, the cover page of that, and more, and then when you arrived at Heathrow. So have you found that edition yet?
I haven't had a chance to get to the store to pick one up.
Okay, well, I will save mine in case you don't get one, because
yes.
Yeah. So, Barbie, before we get into your history with Hef, which is what this show is about, and his legacy, I just wanted to briefly recount our friendship. It's so important to me. We first met 20 years ago. You were singing with the Honolulu Symphony Orchestra. It was a fundraiser
Correct.
For the orchestra. And we met at that. We were at the same table.
And I even remember what I was singing.
Well,
I was singing
it was
music
some operatic
from the Phantom
thing.
Of the Opera.
I think it was, yes. I think it was. And so we started our friendship, and then among your many talents, what emerged was you could do the hula. My goodness.
Ah.
And how wonderful.
That was something
Yeah.
My parents got me into that when I was about 4 or 5 years old, living in Sacramento. My mother was best friends with Joan London's mother.
Yeah.
And they both decided to put us in hula lessons because some Hawaiian lady advertised for hula students. And we were just about the only takers. So
really?
Joanie and I became Sacramento's answer to all of the Hawaiian luau's that were popular back in the 70s. They hired
right.
us. And it was really fun. I mean, we learned how to do every kind of hula known to man, the ancient hula, the hapa-haole hula with the cellophane skirts, and real leaves on our hula skirts. That would be
right.
the ancient hula or anything
right.
really traditional. But Joni and I did that for quite a few years, and then she went off to do Good Morning America when she got older, and I stayed with hula. When you saw me do the hula many times.
Many times, including at some parties at your
mm-hmm.
home with your husband, George, and at my home with my late husband, Charlie, and then even some parties after Charlie died, you came and did the hula, and people would say you were better than the Royal Hawaiian hula dancer who would do the hula with the ocean at her back. but I think you also
that was
there.
The Halekulani.
That was a Halekulani.
I know what you're talking about. She was Miss Hawaii years
That's
ago.
That's right. That's
so,
right. But
yes,
a lot of people said you were better than she was.
You know, what is better? That's competitive and I'm not trying to be better than anybody. I'm just trying to do it as well as I can. But I was in a halau, which is a group of performers in Hawaii.
Yes, you were.
Because I met you when we had a house in Hawaii. And I was very serious about it. Everybody got together at my house and practiced hula about 3 times a week. So we were always ready with about 100 different hulas anytime somebody had a request.
And I think the appeal for you was not only that it was good exercise, but did it have a kind of a storytelling, spiritual aspect for you?
Not when I first started, when I was a very young girl. It wasn't that spiritual. It was just a matter of learning a new dance. But when I started working on it in Hawaii with a group of girls, our teacher, Kathy Ostrom, required that we learn every word in the hula, in the translation so that we knew the meaning of every word in the hula. And you can't dance a hula unless you really know what those Hawaiian words mean.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's really serious because it shows on your face. If you don't know what the words are, you can't really emote.
Emote, because part of it is not only what your hands are saying, but what your face is saying, or maybe even, because some hula dancers will sing along, right?
And nobody's supposed to be looking at your coconuts.
But of course they do. And especially yours,
right.
Barbie. Yours are rather famous. So, so one more little piece that might interest the listening audience of my friendship with you, and then we're going to get to Hef and his legacy and your beginning days with him and your final days with him or visit with him. But in about 2006, you invited me to go with you to the Playboy Mansion, which you found for Hef. We'll get to that story in a minute. But it was fight night, and it was the girls next door, and they were filming it. And you and I and Hef went inside the mansion. Everybody else was outside, and to use the facilities. But and while you were doing that, I had a chance to talk to Hef a little bit about Dr. Helen Fisher's research with brain imaging and how in the early days of a relationship there's lots more testosterone and dopamine running in the brain. And Hef was very attentive. He listened to this. And I just thought he was such a nice man. And he clearly, clearly loved you.
Line of research, Hef put up a lot of money and support for Masters and Johnson,
whom
I met on Playboy After Dark, and they became friends of Hef. Then they came up to the mansion occasionally. It's nice to be surrounded by intellectuals, and there were quite a few as well as the non-intellectuals. In any case,
Masters and Johnson
were doing a lot of sex research to find out about how women had orgasms, et cetera, et cetera. And they really, they went in depth. I'm sure you know all that.
Oh, yes, because they pretty much created, Masters and Johnson, created my field, the field of sex therapy. And I think Hef, he part of his legacy was that he felt that women should and could and should enjoy their sexuality. But when he started the magazine in 1953, we were in a sexually sick time in the United States.
That's, I believe, going to be part of his legacy, a very big part of it, because America was extremely puritanical back in those days, in the 50s.
Right.
And when he came out with Playboy, Playboy became the leader of the sexual revolution. Hef was in the vanguard of the entire movement,
mm-hmm.
where he was saying it was okay to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that people never discussed. Hef was telling me how Elizabethan in nature our country was. I was only three back in 1953, so if you do the math, you can figure out how old this old fart is. But I don't feel like I'm old. I still feel like I'm in high school.
I know, and you don't look like your age, and we last saw each other last July at a mutual friend's
wedding.
You know, these days we go to the offspring's weddings, right, of our friends.
Well, that's true.
But these days
we end up going to more funerals than weddings.
That's sad.
That's bad.
But since
we are talking about Hef, that is one of the saddest things for me.
Yes.
To know about Hef, because I watched his friends die left and right. And he was almost the last man standing.
Oh.
There are a few celebrities that are still around that he knew, but they don't, I mean, like Tony Bennett, I think, is still around.
Yeah, he is.
But he's outlived all of his friends. I'm about the only one left.
Yeah,
and
so maybe I was going to ask you about
the people that he knew way back when. And it's sad because your friends that you've known for 50 years, and I've known Hef for 50 years. That's shocking. But the people that you've known all those years, if you've stayed in touch, they're really your close friends.
Right.
They loved you when you were nothing, and they loved you when you were something. You know?
Correct.
That's why I love my high school friends the best. I mean, I adore my high school friends because they were my friends when I was a nobody.
When you were not
and
a celebrity.
I know they're my real friends, as are you. You and I have been very close all these years.
We have been, and I appreciate you not just for your talent and your celebrity, although I appreciate you for that, but I appreciate you for the substantial woman that you are, with great intellect and talent and generosity and loyalty. Yeah, I sure, and even coming on my show is
I would
a testament
never
of your loyalty
you down,
because
Diana.
What? What?
I just said I would never turn you down.
Oh, never turn me down. Thank you. Well, I would the same back at you. I think the listeners would like to hear, I thought in terms of, if you could recall the first and last times you saw Hef, I think the first time was, you tell us, because you were 18
All
and
right.
he was 42.
Well, I have to preface this with how I got onto the show.
Oh yeah,
I went to a discotheque
at the time, right?
I went to a discotheque in L.A. called The Factory.
I remember
which was actually primarily a gay place, mm-hmm. but it was the most fun place to go dancing. And if you aren't aware of it, gay guys are the best dancers.
Oh, I'm aware.
And they danced with me. Everybody danced with me. It was really fun. People actually danced instead of just watching other people dance. So yeah. I was out on the dance floor, and I was dancing with my agent.
Ah.
When somebody came up to him and said, "Is she in your agency?" And he said, "Yes, she is." And then they complained that he didn't send me on the interview for Playboy After Dark.
Mm-hmm.
So of course that piqued my interest, and I asked what that was, and they said it's a television show that Hugh Hefner from Playboy would be hosting, and they were looking for some girls to be in the background and in a party scene for
right.
the whole show. So I said, "Oh, that sounds like it would have been fun. Why didn't you send me on it?" And he said, "Because I didn't want to ruin your image. I was the hot new chick in town getting all the commercials." So I said, "Well, I would have liked to have done that." I said, "Next time, run it by me, please."
Uh-huh.
And the agent, this other guy said, "Well, if you'd like to be on the show, we hired all the girls that we needed, but I'm the casting director, and I'll add you to the group. If you want to show up on Monday at 9 o'clock, you're in." I said, "I'll be there." So, of course, I was going to UCLA at the time. I had to cut school and
yes.
go make, I don't know, $350 for the day, whatever it came to. It was money.
Well, it was a fair amount of money in 1969, too.
So I was sitting out. They took a break in filming, and I immediately went over and started studying. I opened some books, and I was studying when Hef walked up to me and asked me if I would mind letting him stand next to me and maybe put his arm around me for the show.
Yeah.
So I
ever the gentleman, right?
I said, "Well, I don't know." And he said, "Well, and I'd really like to hold your hand if I could."
Uh-huh.
And I said, "I don't know." But he said, "Let me see if I can get you a line. If I can get you a line where you can say something, you'll make a couple $100 more for the day."
Right, yeah.
So I said, "Oh, I like that." So he came back and said, "Sure, they'll let you say, you know, a couple of words, and then you get paid double." So I said, "Yeah, I'll hold your hand." So anyway, I pretended to be his girlfriend for the day, and I ended up holding his hand for another 9 years almost. So
yes.
it turned into a nice relationship. A really, yes. you know, I never expected to fall in love with a man who was 24 years older than me, but it happened.
But it happened, and you've got a great story about your first conversation with Hef about the age difference. Can you recount that?
Oh, that happened almost immediately at the
yes.
same day. Hef asked me out, and I said, "I don't know, Hef. I've never been out with anybody over 24. And he said, "That's okay. Neither have I."
I love that story.
He was 42, and I was 18.
Right.
That was our
But
age
it endured.
24 years.
Your relationship endured. And, you know, I know you to be a thoughtful, intelligent person, and not only was he intrigued by the fact that you were a student at UCLA at the time, but that you had a brain. You know, you were not a bimbo. and you know, the listeners might be interested that I knew both your parents, wonderful people. They've unfortunately passed on, but Your father was an OBGYN. Your mother was a businesswoman, a realtor, and in fact, you found the mansion for half in right, and she.
That's correct. And,
yes, and she for she.
I wanted. Yeah. The house was not. I think I'll tell that story.
Okay.
When I found the mansion, it was.
Yeah.
I half didn't think that I'd be able to find a house that was worthy of him in Los Angeles.
Yes.
So, of course, I made it my biggest challenge to find him a house. And I said, what would it take you to buy a house in L.A.? And he said that it would take me moving in with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, if I find a house that is good enough for me, I'll move in with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking around and just almost immediately found a gate in Holmby Hills that had a lock on it, but it looked like it went to a beautiful driveway surrounded by, it looked like a really good driveway, and I was intrigued.
Intrigued.
So I hopped the fence and walked up to the house. Of course, I was trespassing, and of course, I was looking for Dobermans or pit bulls or anything that might hurt me. But I didn't hear any dogs barking, so I actually walked all the way up to the house and peeked in the windows, came back, called Hef, and said, I think I found a house for you. Now I have to find out if it's for sale. But the lock on the gate was a good indication that nobody was living in it.
Yeah.
So I gave the address to my mother and asked her to find out who owns it and see if they would be interested in selling. As it turns out, they were going through a big divorce and they were going to have to sell the house. So mom opened negotiations but would never tell them who she was getting the house for. And she did it as a freebie for half, as a gift. So, without
well,
a commission.
You know, so that,
but
that,
she, I
yeah,
will say,
good.
we said to half, well, mom won't take a commission, but if you sell it during your lifetime, you owe her a commission. Now, mom died before half sold the house. And he sold the house before he died.
Yeah.
So he was still in it, and technically she should get $6 million because he bought it for $1.2 million and sold it for $100 million.
Yep, that's I've read that. Yes.
So anyway, I'm still waiting for our commission.
But
what?
You know, you've always had I suppose some of it's the legacy from your mother, but a good eye for homes and interior decoration. I've had the privilege of staying with you. You invited me after Charlie died. I had 10 days with you and George and Aspen, and what a magnificent copper palace you have. It's just incredible. And let's go back
Thank
to you. Half. So, You said that the last time you saw him was about 6 months ago, and mm-hmm. you had an amazing conversation with him about old times. What were some of the, if you don't mind sharing, what were some of the highlights about the old times, and maybe we can extend that to our conversation?
Well, when Hef and I got together, we just talked about all the trips that we had done together.
Yeah.
We went to Africa, and actually we were with Gene Siskel, and on that trip we ended up in, after we did a lot of Africa, and then we ended up in Paris with Yul Brynner and Warren Beatty. And
oh
then
my
we
goodness.
Ended up in, and We ended up going to Spain, and riding horses with Roman Polanski. I remember borrowing his jeans for the horseback ride because I didn't have any with me. And I guess we all know about Roman's escapades.
Yeah.
that was kind of sad because he really didn't believe that that girl was, he didn't know that she was underage. So,
oh.
You know, that's too bad. But whatever.
But anyway, the jeans fit
so we
you,
did,
right?
We did some trips in this big plane. It was a DC-9 stretch version, painted black. And at that time, planes were all white. There was no color on anything, on any of the planes.
Right.
And everybody said, oh, this is going to get too hot and it's going to go down. It's going to crash. You can't paint a plane black. You need to have it white so it reflects the sun. And
I did not know that, but that makes sense.
So Hef was the first person to paint a plane. And he said, I have to have a black plane with a white bunny. And he just wanted it and needed it. So he painted it black, and look what's happened to planes. They're all different colors of the rainbow now. It obviously didn't go down. But it was a great plane. It was all decorated kind of like a cave. So you'd go from one cave to another. It was sculpted inside. And in the back, there was a round bed, just like in the Playboy Mansion in Chicago, and there was a shower. So whenever we went somewhere, if there was going to be a press conference immediately after we landed, we were able to take a shower, and I could do makeup, and I'd get off the plane looking like $1 million, and nobody could understand how you can take an 8-hour flight and look good. But that's how I did it.
That's how you did it. But this is a great example of the good life. Oh, my goodness.
That was the good life, for sure. That was for sure. But unfortunately, it was rather short-lived because Hef didn't love traveling. Too many people come up to him and ask him for his autograph, and not to mention that it's hard work, you know,
mm-hmm.
packing, unpacking, and moving
mm-hmm.
all the time. And he just decided that it was easier to stay home and watch travel shows.
But weren't you the first one to get him to go to Europe? He hadn't been to Europe, and you got him to go.
He had been to Europe for one day. He went
to the
opening of the Playboy Club prior to when I met him, and he came back the next day.
Oh, that was 1966,
The London Playboy Club opened. Before I met him.
Right.
So he had never seen Europe. Then one time I did a film with a German actor named Klaus Kinski, and it was called How Did a Nice Girl Like You Get Into This Business? It was a German comedy, what can I say?
Really? They have them?
And it was filmed in 16 cities.
Oh.
So while they were filming, Hef followed me around from city to city. So he really saw a lot of Europe on that trip. We went all over the place. I played Miss Luxembourg in the movie.
You must have been
adorable.
Kind of
silly. It was silly.
It was silly.
yes, it was. Usually you hear about a French farce or an English farce, but this was a German farce.
Yeah, you don't usually hear about German farces.
No, it's
they're
not.
A little more serious by reputation.
They have a different sense of humor, things that our director found amazingly funny, you know, I didn't laugh at, but you know, what can you say? It's it's a different humor.
Now you have said, Barbie, that Taff was very romantic, that he loved kissing and all of those things. And of course, in my practice, I hear so many women that long for a little more romance from their partner, and so many women really like kissing. They like the emotional foreplay as well as the soft lip foreplay. So he was romantic. You liked that.
Yes. One thing about Hef is that he always had his hands on somebody. Usually it was me, but sometimes, you know, it was no matter who came in the door, he was touchy-feely. He always gave everybody a kiss. And whenever we were sitting together watching a movie, he'd always be rubbing my leg or rubbing my arm and holding my hand, you know. So he was very touchy-feely. I have not had that with anybody before or after, as nearly to the degree that Hef was romantic like that.
Right, right. And with PDA, because some of it was public display of affection, it's kind of like your man is saying, she's mine, and I find her so hot, so attractive. And a lot of men are not very comfortable with public displays of affection. Well, we're not surprised that Hef was fine with it, but didn't you feel that it was kind of, well, how did you feel about that?
Well, I was very proud to be with Hef.
I bet
and
you were.
Whenever we were in public, it seemed like he always had his arm around me, and he took credit for being my boyfriend. He said, "This is my girlfriend, Barbie." And I felt like I belonged with him. I didn't feel like he was slighting me at all.
So he asked you to marry him 4 times. You were with him from, what, 1969 to 1976, thereabouts? And I'm wondering...
1968 through 76.
Okay. And so he asked you to marry him several times. I sort of know the story, but I think the listeners might be interested, if you don't mind. Because this is part of the reason why Hef didn't work out.
Hef always, sometimes he even called me his fiance, even though he'd never asked and I'd never answered.
Right.
But there were many occasions when he introduced me as his fiance, and I never stopped him from saying that. But when he did ask me to marry him, it always fell after I caught him in some kind of an affair. And every time I'd move out, it got to the point where the first time I moved out, I just kept an apartment on the side that I paid for.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if I didn't, if that way I wouldn't have to go to so much trouble to move out.
You know? Right, right.
So, what always happened was he'd ask me to get me back, and I never wanted to go back with somebody who just cheated on me.
Mm-hmm.
So I always said no, and then but there were times in between where I'd give in and say, okay, well, maybe I could do that after we got together and stayed together for another year. Then I'd say, okay, well, maybe I could do the marriage thing, you know. And he'd say, well, you know, we're getting along so well, maybe we shouldn't. And it would just go back and forth.
Right.
He did, however, I will say this, he did ask me the last time to leave my husband and come back to him.
Because the fourth
that one kind of took me off.
Sure.
Because
you already
kilter.
Married
I
to George
said,
at that point.
I can't leave George. I've been married to my husband, George, for 38 years in 3 days.
It'll my goodness, isn't that
October
amazing?
October 14th, 4 days.
Yeah.
We're just trying to work out how we can be in the same city.
I know. And so, you've got two great kids. I love your kids. And
thank you.
A daughter and a son. And, yeah, they're just...
Alex is a chef, and Ariana is an aerialist.
Yes.
She just opened
Isn't
a
her
big
name
studio
perfect?
In Denver.
Yeah.
Might as well give her some PR. It's called the Circus Collective.
Circus
and
Collective. Okay.
She teaches everything that is in the air, just about anything in the air, except flying trapeze. They don't have the room for that. But she teaches trapeze and Lyra. It's this unusual round thing up there, or oval. And silks. She also teaches yoga and acro yoga. People that follow that would understand. That's acro yoga is done with a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually very sensuous.
I bet.
The way you climb all over each other.
So
she leads classes in all kinds of things. And it opened recently, so she's very successful already.
She's
got a lot of classes
Denver.
That are sold out now, and it's only been about a month. So I am not
Denver?
Worried about Ariana, and
yeah.
My son is hopefully on his way to becoming top chef.
Yes, I believe he will be.
I must tell you, Diana,
yes.
and your listeners,
yes.
My son, I had gained about 10 pounds or so over the years, and my son was staying with me at my parents' house, even though they're not here with us anymore.
Yeah.
And he said, Mom, you need to do something about that extra stuff you're carrying. He said, let me fix it. So I said, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do a makeover on me and let's fix it. So I had him cook me, direct me to a diet that he eats regularly. He is a vegan. And I can tell you that with no effort at all, I dropped 9 pounds in 5 weeks from following a vegan diet.
That is amazing.
It was totally amazing. It just kept falling off. I avoided chicken, any kind of red meat, of course, and even fish. And Alex said, if you want to lose it, you know, if you want to go back to doing it once in a while, it's not going to kill you. But he doesn't do it. He's very disciplined about his vegan diet. But in any case, he had me cutting back on oils. And he showed me how you can take a microplaner and microplane some walnuts on top of your salad, which make it looks like you've added cheese. It just turns it into this wonderful little topping that's really just nuts, and those are good for you, but you're eating the whole nut instead of just the oil, like walnut oil or almond oil or something. So anyway, vegan, it's an amazing way to lose weight. And also I find that as I've gotten older, I'm a little bit lactose intolerant. So if I do have to have milk, I go for the lactose-free milk. And anyway, I just thought I'd share that with your
Well, I appreciate that. And of course,
it does definitely make a huge difference. It did for me.
We all saw each other last July at our mutual friend's daughter's wedding, and I thought you looked great. And I know in a recent conversation you told me you'd lost 9 pounds, and that's remarkable. It is harder to lose weight the older we get, and so good for you. And you know, your son was expressing so much love for you by sharing this with you and wanting to help his mama. I love that.
Well, he's often tried to get me onto his diet.
Because well, that would be hard, especially since you head up a gourmet eating group.
Yeah. Yes, I might as well mention that, too. I'm the leader of a group called Chaîne de Rotisserie, which is a food and wine organization.
Which I got you into back in Hawaii. You can blame me.
In 1214. I mean, it's that old in France.
And that's
then
right.
It was revamped in 1950, I believe. But
that's right.
It has 60,000, I think it's 60,000 or 30,000 members around the world, and there are 600 chapters. So if anybody is interested in great food and great wine and wonderful camaraderie, this is the organization for you. And they have a chapter in almost every major city in America. I know there are 130-plus chapters in America. And I'm the Bai, which means the president, the leader of the group in Aspen. I founded the group in Aspen. And it's a lot of work, but
it's
sure
a lot
is
of work.
A nice group to have.
Yes.
In a city where we can be surrounded by tourists and never see each other. So this way we get together several times a year and have our fine food and wine dinners.
Yes, and I belong to the chapter here in Seattle,
in
which
Hawaii.
Is quite active. And we saw each other also, in June in Portland for a Chaîne event. They're fun. The camaraderie is great, and they raise money for chefs. So, since this show is about...
I joined the group I believe it was in the 70s or early 80s at the very least.
No, and you joined when I told you about it. That was 1998.
Was it that late?
Yeah. That's...
Well, it's been a long time in any case, and
yes, it has.
And
you've been
strong.
A great Bai, but you just need a little more help, don't you?
I could definitely use some help.
I know.
So let's being the leader of an organization like that, if you don't have real helpers, all you have are people that are going to take credit for doing what you did. So
well,
in many ways,
unfair.
Before I take on any helpers, I'm going to try them out first and give them a trial of maybe 6 months before I give them the big ribbon, the different colored ribbon for being an officer.
You
but
can
that's
control
true with
this.
Every charitable organization. There are people that really help and people that just want to show up and party.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway.
So, because in the last, 10 minutes or so of the show, I kind of like to circle back to Hef's legacy. And I am going to send you this because it came out in the Seattle Times Thursday, September 28th, the day after Hef died, and the obit, it's quite well written. It came out of Los Angeles, and one of the things that I'd like to quote here and get your reaction to is, Playboy soon became forbidden fruit for teenagers and a Bible for men with time and money, primed for the magazine's prescribed evenings of dimmed lights, hard drinks, soft jazz, deep thoughts, and deeper desires. Within a year of circulation neared 200,000, within 5 years it had topped 1 million, so from the time the first edition was in 1953. So that's part of his legacy, that he was giving, he was suggesting the good life to a lot of men. And did he talk about that with you?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I would guess.
He wrote an article in the magazine called the Playboy Philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked on that all the time. He'd be sitting in the round bed in Chicago writing the Playboy Philosophy. And he just kept adding to it.
Yeah.
But it started with the idea that people should be able to enjoy their money and not hide it. Back when he started the magazine, people were very humble about the way they lived, and they lived with their old pots and pans after they were all decrepit, you know.
Yeah.
And he's saying, hey, why not get the new toaster that does this and the blender that does this, you know, and get yourself a really happening couch and money is to be spent.
Right.
He was pushing the fact that people aren't enjoying their money. And he was saying, you know, go out and get the stereo that you've been dreaming about. What are you going to do? Wait till you die and you're on your deathbed to say, hey, we should buy that stereo. We've saved our money all our lives. He was saying, go out and get it and enjoy yourself. It's your life. You spend your money and have a good time. And stop being so cool about, oh no, we can't go out to dinner. So, he was pushing that, but also in the Playboy Philosophy, he was really pushing the fact that women should be, really considered as equals. He was saying that women should get the good jobs. It was a men's magazine, granted, but he was a real, supporter of women's lib from the point of view of equal pay for equal work and a number of other issues, but then along came Gloria Steinem, and who managed to pretend to be a bunny. She got the job as a bunny, but she had ulterior motives when she got that job. She already planned on knocking the Playboy Foundation for doing what they were doing. But every time I've talked to a bunny, and I've known quite a few in my life, they have said that it was the greatest job they could have had at the time. They were paid well, they were respected because guys were not allowed to pinch the bunnies, and they weren't allowed to date the customers, so they felt very protected. The big deal is that they were paid very well. They were paid much better than most waitresses, and basically they were waitresses. But it was a classy club, and they got to, I've never heard a bunny put down the job with the exception of one little item. Nobody liked the shoes they had to wear. They were they were pointed shoes, and it was a high heel,
which is fine
for about an hour, but after you've been on your feet for 5 hours, your feet hurt.
Of course.
But that, you know, other than that, most waitresses don't have to wear high heels, but Bunnies did.
But they
love their Bunny outfits.
But you have said that Half brought women out of the kitchen, and then you've also said he and his publication got everybody, including women, talking about sex. That's a huge legacy. Huge.
Yeah, I think so.
To begin
the S word was like the F word today.
Mm-hmm.
That came out of the closet too. Things change, you know. When you think of the F word, when I was growing up, if anybody ever said the F word, you'd wash their mouth out with soap.
Right.
But nowadays, the whole connotation has changed. People use it much more freely. And much like sex, the word sex, they couldn't even say it back then. And you know, on TV, you couldn't, two people couldn't sleep in the same bed.
Even if they were married.
Remember those old movies?
Yeah, and you couldn't, and on television, I Love Lucy and so on, and the words sex or pregnant weren't allowed on television back then. I mean, America, when he started Playboy in 1953, America was a sexually sick country.
I agree.
Oral sex, contraception.
I know.
Factual sex education, they were all illegal.
Yes. And many acts that people did to each other behind closed doors were illegal, and people had other people spying on them, and they got thrown in jail
for doing things
that married people should not think twice about.
So here's a quote. Here's a quote from Hess, and I said this to you on the phone, and I think it's brilliant. When religion rather than reason dictates legislation, do not expect logic with your law. That's pretty profound, actually.
It is. It sounds like it was very well thought out, but one of the things that I loved about Hess is that he could spit out little sayings like that without giving them much thought. He just made them up on the spur of the moment, and they were brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I didn't carry a tape recorder half the time. Oh, by the way, on that line, I always digress, but that's the way I am.
I
was very close friends with Andy Warhol, whom mm-hmm. I met through Joan London. And mm-hmm. Andy used to carry a tape recorder everywhere.
Really?
No matter where we were, I was with him in New York and Aspen and wherever. And he always had a tape recorder. So whenever we went to dinner, the tape recorder went on the table, and he recorded every single conversation of his life. I'd say, can't we turn it off? And he'd say, no, I don't intend to do anything with it. He just liked to have it. Kind of strange, but that was Andy.
That, you know, that's another part of your life that was phenomenal as a result of your relationship with Hef. You got exposed to so many great thinkers, great celebrities, great movie stars, and you were at the tender age of 20-ish.
18 when I met him.
Well, I know when you first met him, 18, but it's also, it tells us a lot about you that he's attracted to you. in part because you were mature, way beyond your years, and intelligent, and not so far from being a bimbo. So he liked all of that about you. Plus, you were young. He liked that you were 18, 19, 20. But he appreciated you, and you must have felt that.
I did. I know he was very... He always told people, Barbie goes to UCLA.
Right.
And it wasn't night school. That's
right.
The thing that kills me. People always brag about going to school at Berkeley or something, but it's not really school at Berkeley. It's adult school.
Yeah.
But yes, I'm very proud of the fact that I got into UCLA.
Well, you should be. Barbie, we're coming
it's a tough feat to get into any top school these days.
I know. And Barbie, we're coming to the end of the show, and I just want to express my deep gratitude to you, my dear friend of so many years. You've given us a lot in this program about Hef, some insights, and he really, you know, he did it his way, which when it comes to sexuality is exactly what he would encourage the rest of us to do. Wouldn't you say that?
Yes, he definitely would. And he would definitely want people to have a good sexual relationship. He always felt that was important.
Barbie, thank you. We'll be in touch, you and I, personally, but I'm so grateful for this time with you.
Thank you, and I'm so glad you asked me.
It was a
pleasure. I love talking to you, and it just felt like we were sitting across the table from each other.
I know. That's the nice thing. Okay, we'll be in touch. Thank you again.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Happy feet, da da da, happy feet, da da da, happy feet.